painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
On this episode of Artbeat, we visit with John Swanson, curator for the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. John has a passion for art. He knew at age 10 he loved photography. He's also a historian and a nautical archaeologist. His travels have taken him to research shipwrecks overseas and here in the United States. Today, John visits with us on what it takes to create a successful exhibit.
You get lost in the positive space, that is the art that's on the wall. You don't consider the wall color or the graphics. You just get lost in the story.
John will share with us adventures he's had in his extensive career and give us insight on his favorite exhibits, including Ink and Water, Sailor's Tattoos. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you're listening to Artbeat. Good afternoon. You're listening to Artbeat, and I have John Swanson from Minnesota Marine Art Museum with me. And it's been like, 5 years I've been trying to get you in here?
I'm a busy boy, yes.
Yeah, you are. So go ahead and tell the folks that are listening what you do for the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, because it's quite extensive.
Well, I wear a lot of different hats.
Yeah.
My primary duty is curator. I care for the collections of art that are in the building, and I also design the exhibitions that come through the museum on a regular basis. These are stuff that I curate or bring in from traveling exhibition services, other museums, people like National Geographic or the Smithsonian Institute. So on average, I do about 10 or 12 new exhibitions a year.
How do you go about finding the ones you want to bring in?
Well, we, the museum, operate under the tagline, Great Art Inspired by Water.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is either develop exhibitions that follow that theme or find exhibitions that will fit into that. It could be, you know, a box show from National Geographic of underwater photography. That's easy. Or, you know, shows that I've developed from within our own collection and other museums' collections to put together under a different theme.
But it takes some planning. Like, you have to research, you have to find what's out there.
Absolutely. I generally work 2 to 3 years in advance. So what you see on the walls today, that process began about 3 years ago.
Because they're on loan to other places, too.
They're on loan to other places. You have to develop loan agreements and insurance and travel logistics and all this behind-the-scenes stuff that you don't think about when you walk into a gallery.
Right. It takes planning. And then once it gets to the gallery, you kind of have to figure out how it's going to fit in there, correct?
Correct, yeah. It's laying it out and lighting it and interpreting it, doing the graphics and the wall color and all of that. But that's the fun part, is putting together shows.
So how did you get involved in your art career? You've done a lot of things. You've done underwater diving, history research, things like that. And a lot of things that people do not know about you. So where do we begin?
Well, long story short, I did a BFA undergraduate in art and art history at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And from that, I went to study the history of art, University of London, Courtauld Institute of Art. And then later, I did a second master's degree at Texas A&M University in the nautical archaeology program. So I'm a ship geek with an art historical background, with an artist bent. And I combined all those skills to do what I do today.
Yeah, that fits really well. Like, you found the perfect home for yourself.
And I love Minnesota. And I was I jumped at the chance to move back here and take a job at a new museum and hit the ground running. And I haven't stopped for 10 years.
Tell me a little bit about the underwater bit, the history, the adventures you've been on, because...
Well, what I was doing really was archaeology. It just happened to be underwater, and specifically on shipwrecks. My primary job was a conservator of objects that came up from submerged cultural sites all over the globe. Most of those were shipwrecks. I worked on things from the oldest known shipwreck, 1305 BCE, to the present day, a lot of World War II. Did a lot of work on Civil War, shipwrecks. In the summers, I worked in both Italy and Turkey, diving on Greek and Roman shipwrecks, 7th century BCE, 2nd century, 1st century BCE. And my main project during the year, during the academic year, was working on LaSalle's shipwreck that was found in Texas from 1679. and I was involved heavily in the documentation and conservation of the artifacts from that shipwreck.
What are some things you have to take into consideration when you're working with, A, things that have been submerged for a long time, right?
Correct.
And B, trying to find the historical significance, the age?
Well, there's a lot of clues. A shipwreck is like a time capsule. It's a closed book. It's a finite event in history. From that, we can learn a lot of information. Typical terrestrial archaeology is digging through layers of time, multiple pages from multiple books. But a shipwreck is a singular event. So when it went down, it had everything on board, and it's a snapshot of life at that time. Objects found underwater, there's specific challenges. On some levels, that really helps aid preservation. But for a lot of things like organic materials, wood, leather, bone, it doesn't fare very well underwater unless it's submerged under mud or sand where there's no oxygen, and then it actually preserves things very well. But yeah, you have to treat those objects very carefully. There's a whole course of conservation that you have to do to be able to remove, particularly with salt water, removing salt from those objects and then stabilizing them so that they can be out in oxygen and be able to put on museum display or in a collection or, you know, available to be studied.
I think what's interesting is the U.S. actually has a lot of shipwrecks around it, a lot that people don't even know, especially New York Harbor in that area, too. And there's these people still go on dives for fun.
Absolutely. You know, every great city in North America was founded because they had a good harbor. And in those harbors, there were ships that were burned or scuttled or disposed of or destroyed during war or during, you know, natural environmental hurricane, rain, you know, fire. So, you know, a lot of these harbors are littered with shipwrecks. Not all of them are that important. A lot of them were just towed out and burned and thrown away, disposed of that way. But others were very significant, and they're very important to carefully, scientifically excavate those to extract all the possible information from that record.
What has been the most fascinating one for you?
I've worked on several. I really enjoyed working in Turkey on some of the older wrecks, 7th century BCE. You're looking at material culture and objects from something from that far back and turning over a piece of clay underwater and seeing someone's fingerprints in it that haven't been seen for millennia is pretty powerful.
Yeah, I would think so. What made you want to pursue art?
Boy.
I mean, and what's your medium? Like, I know you, from online, I know you do photography.
I do a lot of photography.
Yeah, you do.
I'm formally trained in photography and graphics, sculpture, painting, and drawing. I still very much enjoy those. But people ask me, what is my art today? Today, my art is the exhibitions that
right.
I put up. And that takes a lot of skill and a lot of different diverse talents to put all that together into a show that's presented to the public. I'm a storyteller, really.
So when you went to school, were you focused on, I'm going to work in a museum someday, or what were you thinking?
I was leaning towards that. I had interned at a museum and then did a second internship at a marine museum, and it really kind of put me on that path.
So you feel like you get to be creative by the way you get to source the objects out throughout the museum? And
absolutely. Every single day is problem solving and being creative. It's a double-edged sword because I have to produce quality shows, but I get to do what I want.
And your name's out there with it. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I either sink or swim on how well I do. So.
And it is a full-time job. You have
very much
yeah,
so.
Yeah. And after hours, too, I assume.
I put in a lot of long hours when there's exhibition changes, but you know, I care deeply and passionately about it, so I want it to look good and do well. And every year we've grown in attendance and membership and sponsorship, so you know we're continuing that upward tick. And part of that is, you know, programming, educational programming. Part of that is exhibitions.
So you have a process, whether the audience realizes it or not, and how you approach things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's your photography, your drawing, or what have you. Is the same process applied across all your mediums and into the museum?
I like to say if I do my job really well on an exhibition, I'm invisible. You get lost in the positive space. That is the art that's on the wall. You don't consider the wall color or the graphics or the font on the text panel or the video that's playing. You just get lost in the story. And again, if I do it very well, you don't think about what went into doing that. You just get into the subject.
how do you create that for yourself when you're putting it up?
I have to take a step back and imagine, you know, walking into this room for the very first time and seeing something I've never seen before. Even though I've spent months and months researching and putting it together, I have to look at it with fresh eyes as a first-time visitor would. And I have to imagine myself in that position.
A lot of people don't understand how important lighting is to the pieces of work that are on display.
Good lighting is invisible. You don't notice it. You just notice the art. But if something's really poorly lit or ill-lit, and you can't quite read something or can't make out a detail, then it kind of throws you off and you don't really get the full experience. So again, these details are important. You know, if you go to the theater, you don't think about the people working the curtains and running the spotlights and doing the sound and all of that. You get lost in the story. And that's what I strive for, is for when people come in and look at a new exhibition, they get lost in the story.
What have been some of the most valuable learning experiences you've had throughout your career?
Oh, man.
Because you don't just get to where you are without life's experiences, you know?
Yeah, but I think always be hungry for knowledge. Always try to do better than what you've just done. Always try to just keep improving and developing, you know, better and better work. But stay curious. I look at a lot of subjects that I know nothing about, and I'll take them on. And after a few months, I really feel like I'm comfortable and knowledgeable that I can present that to the public.
Well, I've had a lot of artists in that say, I learned more once I got out of school. It wasn't necessarily what I learned in school. It was once I started applying it.
Well, it's a classic case. You know, if you go to art school, they teach you art, but they don't teach you how to be an artist. You go to law school, they teach you the law, but they don't teach you how to be a lawyer. So that real world wisdom tempered with academic intelligence and learning is important. You have to have the base knowledge and then get thrown on in the real world and produce and really be able to, you know, put stuff together.
What was your first real world experience?
Oh man, I've had a lot of jobs. I will say I did value as an undergraduate my time as an intern at a museum, a university gallery. It really opened my eyes to, you know, what really is involved to put together a major exhibition. People don't realize that this is planned years in advance. Travel considerations and funding and grant writing and educational components to it and loan agreements and insurance and packing and crating and, you know.
You had a whole world kind of thrown at you there, huh?
Exactly. You know, so there's a lot more beneath the surface than what you see, but I found that really fascinating and I really enjoy doing it.
Is this what you want to keep doing for the rest of time?
Well, I don't know. I'll never say never, but I absolutely love doing what I'm doing, working with the quality of art that I have, and I really enjoy the museum I work at. I enjoy my coworkers. You know, in any other place, I might be just one small cog in a wheel, doing just one thing every day. For me now, everything, every day is different. I do different things, so I don't get bored. I don't get complacent. I'm challenged. I'm forced to be creative, and it really feeds me. It really gives me a lot of energy, and I just love it.
Now, a lot of artists will go ahead and they'll get validation from, oh, I loved your painting, I love this, this, and this. How do you get your validation since you're behind the scenes there?
Well, I look at a lot at Google Analytics to see, you know, how much website traffic we get when we announce a new exhibition. I look at visitors' comments. I hear our volunteers' feedback from our public. And I just look at the numbers, you know, what are the attendance numbers for the weekend when we open a new show? We look at, donations. You know, if we continue to keep building that up every single year, we're doing something well. We're doing something right.
Now, recently, you had a new, I would want to say, captain switch, so to speak, for you over at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. It's been good.
We have a new executive director, whom we unveiled in April. Her name is Nicole Chamberlain, and we more or less poached her from the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. Unfortunately, we lost our previous director, Andy Mouse, who took a position at the Plains Art Museum where he began his career, and his family's from there, his children were from there, so it was a very good personal decision for him and professional decision for him. We were sad to let him go, but, you know, we looked at it as a new opportunity to bring in someone young with a lot of energy and really good creative ideas, and to meet some of the challenges that we want to meet in the next, you know, decade.
You guys have been expanding every year, it seems like.
Well, we opened in 2006, and we've expanded three times in 10 years. And
as of now. That's kind of unheard of, isn't it?
It's a lot. We've more than doubled our exhibition space in less than 10 years. But where we are now, we can't build up and we can't build out. So now we're expanding from within. That means better educational programming, better exhibitions, better marketing, better advertising, other programs to bring in more and more people.
Well, and that means more challenges for you then, too.
Absolutely. But again, that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, right? If it was the same thing every day, you probably wouldn't be doing. You'd probably be out on a dive or something like that.
I would get bored very quickly. I love a good challenge. So. Mm-hmm.
So you are still taking photos, we mentioned. Is there ever going to be a John Swanson exhibit?
Not at the museum, but maybe around town. I've had several offers from a couple different places. And, you know, photography is my first love of art. I grew up, I had my own darkroom, which I bought by the time I was 10 years old. So all through junior high school and high school, I shot, regular film for personal projects, for art projects, for class, school newspaper, yearbook, those kinds of things. And then from that, when I was an undergraduate, I took every photography course that was offered, and I excelled at it. I loved it. And
how did you find that at that age, such a young age?
I just always enjoyed taking photos, but then I kind of just, you know, researched and fell in love with the whole process of developing. And once you actually saw it, I went to a community darkroom, and the first time you see a blank piece of paper and a tray of chemicals come to life and you see an image develop, you're hooked.
And you got to learn dodging and burning with all that. I remember trying to do that.
Well, even in my last position at the laboratory at Texas, I was still doing film. I was doing a lot of film scanning, but I had to do some dark work, and they couldn't believe that I knew how to do this. So I had a backlog of stuff they wanted printed and developed, and I said, sure, yeah, I could get some fresh chemicals. Let's do this. And they were amazed that someone knew how to do it in this day and age. I'm also a huge, huge Photoshop geek. I spend hours a day in Photoshop, and I look at it as just another tool. I had asked Ansel Adams' son, Michael, when we had a show of his father's work at the museum, what would your father think of Photoshop? He said, oh, he would have loved it. He would have threw his darkroom away. He would have ran with it.
I'm done with this.
Yeah, it's a time saver. Now, there are traditionalists, and you know, there is an art to developing and printing and in a normal, you know, chemical process. And I still appreciate that. I don't knock it. But the pace of my job for work photography, yeah, there's no way I could do.
No.
No. So,
do you still have a darkroom?
I don't. No. Okay, no. Right. But, you know, I still know how to do it.
Let me tell you, when you find 20 rolls of film and you need them developed and you find out how much they charge for them in town.
You do your own.
Yeah, you do your own and you send it out. You farm it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you do. It feels like a lost art form now.
Well, I think it'll come back. I don't think it'll ever go away. There's something magical about that process. I still, again, remember the very first time I saw a print come to life. You could visualize it in a tray of chemicals when I was a kid, and I was hooked.
It's magic.
Yep. Alchemy. You know.
In a way. For you, you feel satisfied with what you're doing, your life in Winona, even though you've had so many adventures outside?
No, it's great. I chose to be here. I knew what I was getting into. I researched it. I love Minnesota. I very much wanted to be here doing something in my field of interest. I love four seasons. And I enjoy the best of winter and the best of summer and everything in between. So I've got a really good balance. I've got a small staff, and I'm integrated in a lot of the arts community and other organizations going on in this town. And it's been really fun to be one spoke in the wheel of change in Winona, seeing culture beget culture, art beget art, and turning this town into kind of a destination for, you know, festivals and museum and art. And, you know, we still have a lot of work to do,
but it's
been good to see it move in the right direction.
I think if we can get the downtown even more alive, that will definitely help us out in the long run. But we have some interesting art initiatives, Art of the Rural, with that moving in.
Absolutely. I've worked with them from the day he considered moving here and others. I was on the Fine Arts Commission for several years. So I'm currently on our version of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Amendments District at the Southeast Minnesota Arts Council. I'm a panelist there, and I'm very happy to donate my time to help bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars into artists and arts organization in our region.
It's awesome because you're so active. You're at every event that I'm at, usually probably more than I'm at.
I try to go to most, but, you know, I generally want to be there. I don't feel it as an obligation or a duty or part of my job. It's just, you know, I'm hungry for knowledge. I like to learn, and I like to see what else is going on in my community.
Do you have a personal website for people to find your stuff?
No? No, I don't. I do it as, I don't want to say a hobby, but I've fallen back in love with photography. We've talked about this, but... Mm-hmm. I may change that. I may actually start doing stuff on the next level and putting together an online portfolio and doing some exhibitions and stuff. Because I know a good curator who could put it together for me. So
you think? Anytime you got an exhibition coming up, come on in. Tell us about it.
I talk about the tattoo exhibition?
Do it right now. Because I love the tattoo arts.
Well, it's a huge subject, but the museum just opened a new exhibition called Ink and Water, Sailor's Tattoos. It's going to run through December 4th of this year. And what it looks at specifically is the sailor's tradition of tattooing in North America from basically the Revolutionary War up to the present day.
You don't think of Revolutionary War with tattoos,
usually.
Well,
this is where this tattoo tradition came from. If you have a tattoo today, it's because of a sailor. Tattoos were brought to North America by Europeans. Today's tattoos. Now, I've got to be very clear on this. The American Indian tradition, a lot of different groups had their own tattoo tradition that went back to prehistory. Mm. We don't know how long this is going on. Different groups all over North America already had a firmly entrenched tattoo tradition. But the tattoos, the sailors' tattoos that you think of today, those came primarily from England. This was a skill that was done during downtime on long voyages, older sailors to younger sailors. That knowledge was passed down. There was no way to formally learn how to do this. There weren't books on the subject. You had to know someone who knew how to tattoo to learn from them. And that's how that tradition started. Once we formed a Navy, that iconography changed a little bit to be a little more patriotic and a little more in line with America versus the iconography that we saw coming from England and France. So that really was a new American art form, and that is American sailors' tattoos.
I remember my grandfather, who was a sailor, mm-hmm. had some tattoos. I remember that quite vividly. And the ink was not that great back then.
No.
No.
Up until 1890, it was done by hand with needles. So all the tattoos done during the Revolutionary War, Spanish-American War even, Civil War, both North and South, those were done in the hand tradition. And what's important to note is, you know, what they tattooed. This wasn't fashion or self-expression. These were badges of honor, commemorative, battles that you'd been in, places that you'd visited. And a lot of the tattoos had very specific meanings to sailors. So if you've sailed across the Atlantic, you earned the right to wear an anchor. If you did 5,000 miles at sea, you could put a swallow, a bird, on your body. If you did 10,000, you could put a second one. If you sailed around South America, the Cape of Good Hope, a very dangerous proposition back in the day, and survived, you earned the right to have a fully rigged ship tattoo on your body. So a ship captain could look at a potential sailor and say, I know where you've been. I know what you've done. I know what you can do on a ship. This is your visual CV. This is your resume.
Your diploma.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's your record of work. So, you know, no one could take that away from you.
That's interesting. I see. I didn't even know that. That's mm-hmm. awesome. And then you're showing works all the way up to Ed Hardy, correct?
Up through some contemporary photography.
Yeah.
I don't have pieces from Ed Hardy in the show. Currently, no.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But a huge history, and I'm mm-hmm. sure it's very well lit and explained when we go in there.
It's a big subject, but it's very important to know that this isn't the history of tattooing. It's really looking at the sailor's tradition in America, and even that is a long story with a lot of really interesting and colorful, literally and figuratively, characters. A lot of these people, these artists, were self-taught, were not formally trained, barely literate, but they were creative and really produced, you know, unknowingly, a new American art form.
It is. For some reason, it also makes me think of the pinup girls on the plains. I don't know why.
It's similar iconography, but that goes, you know, if you go back 100 years or 200 years, they're looking at ship iconography, looking at eagles and
carved. The busts.
Yeah. Figureheads. And some of that worked its way into skin art. You know, a lot to do with patriotic symbols, a lot to do with, you know, military experience or naval experience, ports you've been to, and people you've lost. Also, you know, superstitious tattoos. Sailors would often put a tattoo of a rooster on one foot and a pig on the other. Because in the golden age of sail, wooden ships carried live food with them to slaughter along their way. These animals were kept in wooden cages. Now, should the ship sink, those cages would float and those animals would survive. So sailors believed if they had those animals on their feet, they wouldn't drown.
Oh, I gotcha. Not just the mermaid superstition.
Well, mermaids were supposed to be good luck if you're thrown overboard, or a shark tattoo meant it would ward off a shark attack if you were thrown over in shark-infested waters.
I'll need to remember that the next time I go diving.
You could put your preventative shark tattoo on.
Exactly. What's been your favorite exhibition at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum?
Oh, that's a tough question, because I've worked with so many great regional artists, living artists, and I've got to work with some just amazing historical art as well. I could give you, I don't know, three examples, the Ansel Adams show I referenced, he was a personal hero of mine. I studied a lot of photography, and be able to look at a show that he printed and gave to his daughter, it was 100 pieces, and it was really a love letter to her. It was his favorite pieces, not the critics' favorite pieces, stuff that he was most proud of, his own personal selection of his greatest hits. So that show did very well for us, and I was very pleased to meet his son. And his son was very pleased with the show. So that, professionally felt really good. I thought our Audubon show, I did an exhibition of John Audubon's Birds of America. Yeah, it's at the time, it was the world's most expensive book when I did that show. And that was really fun to put together and display and interpret.
You got to turn the page every once in a while?
Yes. A tattoo show too, I guess, has been really fun for me. It was a lot of work, but it was really a labor of love, because I had to really do a lot of research and a lot of field work to bring in items from a lot of different sources from all over. And I wanted it to be an invitation for a lot of people who've never been to the museum before. This might be what makes it accessible for them to come in the very first time, because they think, oh, this might not be for me or whatever. But if that subject interests you, or if you have a tattoo, you very much want to go see this show.
It's different. It's out of the box for you guys.
But it's very relevant to what we're doing. It's great art inspired by water. It's integrated into our collection. There's pieces that reference what was going on in the tattoo show now. So it really is part of our history.
And if you want more information on that, that's at mmem.org through December.
Yep, December 4th.
Oh, my. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, God, you're more than welcome.
Yes.
Thanks again to John Swanson, curator for the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, for sharing with us today on ArtBeat. More information on the Minnesota Marine Art Museum and to find John can be found at mmam.org. I'm Terry Tensett, thanking you for listening to ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.